courtroom convened shortly. The court does and will ask you to rise as the judges enter the court. Argument by all counsel and by amicus curiae may take about 90 minutes. Upon conclusion, the chief judge will officially adjourn the court. The judges will take a brief recess to change out of their judicial robes and then return for a Q&A session for the benefit of the students. You may remain behind for that if you would like. The Chief Judge and the Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near. For the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. We are hearing oral arguments in the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals program today with students and supervising professors. We're participating virtually from the University of Denver Stern College of Law, appearing remotely from Denver, Colorado, as amicus curiae. The court calls the case of United States versus Staff Sergeant Hannes Marshall, number ACMS 32776. In today's oral argument, we consider the following two issues. One, whether appellant's conviction under Article 134, Uniform Code of Military Justice, 10 U.S.C. Section 934, was barred by the preemption doctrine because the misconduct is covered by Article 120C, UCMJ, 10 U.S.C. Section 920C. Two, whether the military judge failed to resolve an issue of fact as to actus reus and failed to determine whether appellant's conduct fell within a protected liberty interest, thereby rendering appellant's guilty plea improper. Counsel for appellant, are you prepared to proceed with oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government, are you prepared to proceed with oral argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the guy for the appellant, are you prepared to proceed? I understand there are two of you and you'd like to split your time.
That's correct.
Thank you. And amicus for the appellee, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Johnson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Joshua Lopes, and I represent Staff Sergeant Hannes Marshall, the appellant in this case, along with Colonel Pilar Winger. Staff Sergeant Marshall was convicted of an offense that was not cognizable by the trial court because it violated the preemption doctrine. Therefore, this court should set aside the conviction. In the alternative, if the conviction was not preempted, this court should still set aside the conviction because the military judge failed to clarify what constituted actus reus for the conviction, and because the acts that Staff Sergeant Marshall pled guilty to was not indecent. Staff Sergeant Marshall was originally charged with indecent exposure under Article 120 Charlie, Uniform Code of Military Justice. This specification alleged essentially that he stood naked in the doorway of his residence, exposing his penis to the public. This charge contained three elements. First, that he exposed his genitalia. Second, that the exposure was in an indecent manner. And third, that the exposure was intentional. However, through plea agreement, his plea was changed to indecent conduct under Article 134. And this charge also contained three elements: that he was standing at or near the door of his residence, naked in view of the public, that the conduct was indecent, and that under the circumstances, this conduct was of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces. The third element of this 134 offense was of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces, is commonly referred to as the terminal element. In Avery, the CAF said that the terminal element is not considered in a preemption analysis. Under the preemption doctrine, an offense covered or cannot be charged under the general article of 134 if it is already covered in Articles 80 through 132 of UCMJ. And the plea agreement in this case violated that doctrine because the parties took what was appropriately charged under Article 120 Charlie as indecent exposure and simply called it a 134 offense. And this is not permitted. In Grijalva, the CAF makes clear that when reviewing a preemption issue, there is no need to delve into legislative history when the elements of the offense are essentially the same. Here, the elements of indecent exposure and the 134 offense which Staff Sergeant Marshallwick was convicted of were essentially the same. As the government concedes at pages 15 and 16 of his brief, the first two elements of indecent exposure and of indecent conduct are essentially the same. The only distinction between these two offenses comes from the third element. However, like the CAF said in Grijalva, these distinctions are illusory because the third elements of these offenses do not and should not impact the preemption analysis. The original 120 charge and the final 134 charge address the same conduct, standing naked at the neighbor's door in view of the public. The first two elements of these offenses were the same. They address the same conduct. They had the same definition of indecent used by the military judge, mirrored the definition of indecent manner found in Article 120 Charlie. And the parties in the military judge used the word exposed or exposing or some form of that word over 25 times at trial. Further, Your Honors, the military judge himself at page 171 of the transcript plainly says that Staff Sergeant Marshall was found guilty of indecent exposure. And this was after accepting his plea to Article 134 indecent conduct. The parties in this case tried to circumnavigate the Uniform Code of Military Justice by taking what in a specification, an offense which is codified under UCOJ, and simply calling it a general parole article offense.
So, counsel, a couple of times now you've referred to what the parties have done to include the appellant. And it was the appellant's plea by acceptance and substitution of the presumptive plea agreement whereby all of this happened. So, as you know, the government's inviting us to revisit the Jones decision. So I'd be interested to hear your views on whether that would be advisable or not.
Yes, Your Honor. This court should not overturn Jones. There's no reason to overturn Jones. As this court held in Jones, preemption is not a weighable issue. And that's based on the CAF's decision in Robbins, where the CAF held that preemption is not a weighable issue. It was not weighed by an appellant's guilty plea. CAF's rationale for Robbins was that an offense created under Article 134 is not cognizable when it is already covered in Articles 80 through 132. And in Robbins, the CAF outlined the standard preemption test, standard principles of preemption, and clearly states that preemption relates to subject matter jurisdiction and therefore is not weighable. This court has adhered to Jones repeatedly and to Robbins for nearly two decades in cases such as Costians, Hill, Bailey, and Dominguez-Sandoval. And with regard to the stare decisis factors, none of the factors warrant overturning Jones. And even if they did, there is no unique circumstance or special justification which would warrant overturning Jones.
The CAF, I'd like to ask you about Humphrey. So the CAF decision, I understand it was about failure to allege an offense due to a defective specification and not necessarily about preemption per se, but it did say that rules should not be considered jurisdictional unless they go to a court's adjudicatory capacity. So does Humphreys undermine the theory or the logic of Jones and Robbins, even if it doesn't specifically address preemption specifically?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. As you noted, Humphreys was not the preemption issue, and it does not change what preemption ultimately is getting at. Preemption is about an offense not being cognizable because Congress has already occupied the field for that type of misconduct under Articles 80 through 132.
So does preemption go to our capability to adjudicate?
Yes, Your Honor. It goes towards a trial court whether an offense is cognizable by a trial court. That's what the CAF held in Robbins, and therefore, Humphreys does not alter that. Humphreys dealt with a 134 specification which omitted the terminal element. That's very different from whether an offense is even cognizable whether the offense itself can be charged. It's different than even copy which the government asserted or relies on its brief, which dealt with indictment defects. Those are different. This is not a procedural issue. This is not a defective charging scheme or issuing pre-referral or referral. This deals with whether the offense itself can be adjudicated by the trial court, which the preemption doctrine says it cannot. And that is why it's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction.
So, counsel, Robbins had to do with and can properly assimilate offense under clause 3. So, this is not a clause 3 case. So, do we not have the power to adjudicate clause 1 and 2 cases?
No, Your Honor, this court does not, or not this court, the trial court does not, if it is barred by the preemption doctrine. That is because while the vehicle at issue in Robbins was a clause 3 preemption case or claim, there is nothing in the Robbins decision that limited it to clause 3 offenses. The preemption doctrine applies equally to clause 1, 2, or 3 of the general article. The preemption language, which courts have derived the preemption doctrine from, exists at the beginning of 134, applies equally to all three. In Robbins, the court outlines the standard preemption analysis, the standard preemption test, and yes, while the issue there was a matter of clause 3, there's nothing in its decision which says it is limited to clause 1 or only to clause 3.
Counsel, is this essentially a notice issue? For example, does it change the argument that you're making, given the fact that the appellant pled guilty and also negotiated for the terms under the Article 134 specification?
No, Your Honor, that does not change the analysis. In Grijalva, one of the CAF's most recent decisions related to preemption, the CAF highlighted an example dating back to 1953 in a case called Norris. And in there, the CAF outlines that from the earliest example of the preemption doctrine being utilized, that case involved an accused attempting to plead guilty to the general article offense when it was already covered by Article 121. In there, CAF said that the legal officer appropriately denied to accept that plea. The fact that an individual attempts to plead guilty under 134 does not change the analysis. Specifically, additionally, because jurisdiction defects do not require prejudice or anything along those lines. They cannot be waived. And similarly, in this case, this court should not find that this decision was waived, even though it was pursuant to a plea agreement.
Counsel, we do have a line of cases that are cited in the brief, Humphrey, Cotton, Allen, among others, and charging defects are raised the first time on appeal. The court applies a plain error analysis. So, what is your argument for a de novo versus a plain error analysis?
Your Honor, it's that the preemption issue is not a charging defect, it is a jurisdictional defect. In this court, it does not apply a plain error analysis for a jurisdictional defect.
Let's say we were to apply a plain error analysis. What is your argument that the standard is not?
Your Honor, it would be that Staff Sergeant Marshall was convicted of an offense which was barred by the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It was an unlawful plea agreement. It was error for the military judge to accept it. If it's a plain error analysis, then it's that the military judge should have recognized plainly that the preemption doctrine should have barred this. There was no inquiry by the military judge into whatever we discussed the incident of whether preemption was implicated. And we should. But that's not required, Your Honor, pursuant to this case, this court's decision in Jones, in following the CAF's decision in Robbins, that it is not a plain error analysis, it is a jurisdictional defect that is developed.
So to follow up on Senior Judge Broom's question regarding notice, the prejudice prong is typically cast in terms of whether there was adequate notice. So, do we have a notice issue here, where he was originally charged correctly, negotiated the language in the specification, and then was appealed to it after being advised during the colloquy and admitted to that.
Your Honor, while prejudice was not specifically briefed by either party, it's not raised in the briefs, there is a cap decision, Alexander, 61 NJ 266 at 269. And in that case, it discusses that jurisdictional defects go to the underlying authority of a court to hear a case. A jurisdictional error mandates reversal. And it specifically distinguishes those from procedural errors, which must be tested for prejudice to determine whether relief is warranted. Because preemption is a jurisdictional matter pursuant to the CAF's precedent and this court's precedent, prejudice is not required. That is not the analysis for this court for this issue.
Does the fact that the appellant stipulated in a stipulation of fact that the court had personal and subject matter jurisdiction affect your argument or analysis?
No, Your Honor, because that was incorrect. That was error. It was something which was overlooked seemingly by trial counsel, defense counsel, and the military judge. An individual saying there's jurisdiction specifically over him, I'm not arguing that. The court had personal jurisdiction over him as an Air Force member, but for the subject matter jurisdiction, that is what is issued with this preemption analysis. And the court did not have subject matter jurisdiction. It is because this offense was preempted, because the elements of the offense were a residuum of Article 120 Charlie, that this court should find the preemption doctrine applies, that this plea agreement should have been rejected, and this court should set aside the conviction based on the preemption doctrine. In the alternative, if this court does not find the preemption doctrine applies, or if this court overturns the precedent in Jones, this court should still set aside Staff Sergeant Marshall's conviction because the plea he entered was improper, specifically for two reasons I would like to address. The first being that the military judge failed to resolve the issue regarding what the actus reus for the offense is, and the second being that if the actus reus is what Staff Sergeant Marshall intended to plead guilty to, that conduct was not indecent. The first issue, the military justice system places great responsibility on military judges to ensure that an accused guilty pleads properly. In this case, the military judge failed in that responsibility by failing to clarify what conduct constituted the actus reus for this conviction. Staff Sergeant Marshall pled guilty to standing naked at the nearest doorway in view of the public. He specifically pled not guilty to standing outside his residence, exposing his penis to the public, and he pled not guilty to public masturbation. During his care, a military judge asked him why he was guilty. He explained he was guilty because on two occasions, he finished working at his home, he put his clothes in the washing machine, and he propped the front and back doors to his home open with a chute for airflow. He estimated he spent approximately 10 to 20 seconds at a nearest doorway while he was doing this. However, the stipulation of fact contained a different characterization of what he did on these occasions. Instead of merely standing at the nearest door, propping it open with the shoe, the stipulation of fact contained allegations that he was posing while, or that he was touching his penis while in view of the public.
So, counsel, you would agree that these are stipulations of expected testimony, essentially. Appellant didn't stipulate to the truth of what this testimony was then.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, is it your position that the military judge should have properly limited their consideration with regard to providency to what it was that appellant told him verbally during the guilty plea inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any reason to believe the military judge didn't do that?
The issue here, Your Honor, is that the military judge failed to clarify how he was using it sufficiently. It leaves open substantial doubt that the military judge did, in fact, rely on greater information. In both the government's answer at page 24 and in the amicus at page 10, the parties argued that it's these more egregious acts alleged in the stipulation of fact that make the conduct issue indecent. It's relied upon by the parties to overcome the element that it must be indecent. That alone raises substantial doubt and concern that it is those more egregious acts which he was convicted of, when that was not his intent when pleading guilty.
Could be those more egregious acts potentially go to the government's burden to prove the terminal element under 134?
No, Your Honor, because that record marshal did not agree with the truth of the matter asserted by those witnesses. He did not agree that he was touching the police in public. He did not agree to going outside of his home and posing with the more egregious acts alleged.
So, I'm sorry, that's my fault. So you're saying he didn't agree with the witness statements, but isn't it true during his care inquiry that the military judge asked the appellant, do you have any reason to question or doubt whether those women in fact saw you standing naked in the doorway on those particular dates? He said, no, Your Honor. The military judge followed up, is it your belief now, having seen the statements of these particular witnesses, that they did in fact see you on those days as they have described? Yes, Your Honor. So he essentially adopts the statements of the witnesses, doesn't he?
No, Your Honor, he doesn't. What he's doing there is saying, yes, the context of that portion of the transcript in the colloquy was that Sergeant Marshall said he was not aware at the time when he opened the door that anyone had seen him. He later found out that two witnesses said they saw him. So in that portion of the transcript, he was admitting and acknowledging that he does not doubt that they saw him. He was not, however, adopting what they said he was doing on those instances. He was admitting and agreeing that they saw him when he opened the door, but he was not saying, I agree, I was doing those more egregious things while they saw me. And that is the fundamental issue with this actus reus of the plea, is there is doubt about, did the military judge rely on what those witnesses said he did versus what he said he did?
And counsel, maybe you're getting it, just to be clear. So your position is based on what he verbally said to the military judge alone during the guilty plea inquiry, that would be insufficient for a province to plead to this point.
Yes, Your Honor. If what he was convicted of factually was merely standing naked at a mayor's door while he was opening it to profit open with the shoe, that is insufficient because it is not indecent. That conduct was not indecent. Because what he said he did was briefly opening the door to profit open with the shoe. That conduct alone is not grossly vulgar, obscene, or repugnant conduct. He specifically, it's because it's distinguishable from what this court and courts have looked to as indecent conduct in the past. Staff Sergeant Marshall did not wait until he specifically saw people pass by and open the door to expose himself. He did not walk down the street nude waving at people. He did not ask for someone specifically to come into his home and then appear nude in front of them. That is the type of indecent conduct this court has looked to in the past, not mere nudity for approximately 10 to 20 seconds while he was opening the door where someone could see him.
So how does appellant's admission that he intentionally stood in the door naked and exposed to the public because he was sexually aroused by the prospect that someone from the public might see him affect this argument?
Your Honor, Staff Sergeant Marshall did say he received mental excitement at the prospect that someone could see him. However, that conduct alone, the prospect that someone could see him, does not rise to the level of grossly vulgar, obscene, or repugnant conduct. It was immediately and immediately alone. And while he may have received mental excitement from that prospect, that is insufficient to rise to the level of being indecent. In the amicus in support of the appellee, their brief provides an example from Missouri. Understanding that's not binding this court, but it's an example that is similar and highlights why Staff Sergeant Marshall's conduct was not indecent. In State v. Jeffrey, the appellant was prosecuted for exposing his genitals to minors under the age of 15 by standing in his windows or near his door on several occasions. On its face, that appears similar to this case. However, in that case, the court specifically noted that the statute required that the accused was aware he was exposing his genitals to a person less than 15 years of age, and that he knew his conduct would cause an affront or harm or alarm. For nudity to be indecent, there must have been intent and knowledge of the specific victim and the intent. The court specifically in that case said being nude without knowledge of who was or who might be seeing him was insufficient to support a conviction. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Said, yes, Staff Sergeant Marshall admitted he knew it was possible he could be seen, and he received mental excitement from that, but he did not specifically see people out. He expressly says he did not know he was being seen when he opened the door. The nudity in this case did not rise to the level of being grossly vulgar or repugnant. It is not indecent. And it's distinguishable from a case this court reviewed similarly in Carlisle, where the appellant in that case sent digital images of his genitals to a specific person who knew, did not consent to it, and he intentionally sought that out. This is distinct from that, Your Honor. He did not seek out any particular person. He did not invite people into his home to expose himself to them. This was nudity, mere nudity, for a brief moment of time as he was opening the door for the primary purpose of creating an airflow, which is what he said during his care.
Counsel, I'd like to follow up on paragraphs 5 and 6 of the stipulation that those three essential stipulations of the testimony. Part of your argument is that the military judge erred by not reconciling contradictions between care, inquiry, and the testimony, the stipulated testimony in those paragraphs. So you've argued that the appellant did not stipulate to the truth contained in those stipulated paragraphs. And so if stipulations of effective testimony are not equivalent of admissibility or testing the truth of the statements as facts, then what contradictory facts are they?
Your Honor, it's that in this is, I understand the confusion and contradiction seemingly with it, that it was included in the stipulation of fact, and in that, at the heart of it, is where the military judge erred. It is how it was reconciled that we have this stipulation of fact that said these witnesses would say this, but I don't agree with it, but I'm going to include it in the care inquiry. And the military judge just included a passing note that you understand they would say this, but you don't agree with the truth.
But your argument is there's contradictory facts that the military judge failed to reconcile, and so they don't constitute facts and the answer to the question. Then what contradiction was there to be reconciled?
Your Honor, it's that the fact was included. Staff Sergeant Marshall did not agree with the fact. He did not say that fact was true, but the military judge did not say, I will not consider this fact. I will not consider this as a basis for a conviction.
Well, the judge advised him that if these witnesses were to testify, that's what the witnesses would testify to, not necessarily to the truth of what those witnesses are saying, accused. Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor. And the issue is that those witnesses allege different actions. They allege different conduct than what he essentially testified to during his care inquiry, where he said, I only stood at my door to profit over the shoe. He was not agreeing to do those things, but the military judge allowed this stipulation to include contradictory facts that, no, you did not just stand at your door. You were actually touching the penis. You were opposing me in public. And while Staff Sergeant Marshall did not agree with those facts, that is where the error comes in. If Staff Sergeant Marshall had said, I agree, I did those things, Your Honor, there wouldn't be an issue of whether that could be an act in the act's race for the defenses. But it's because he said, I don't agree that that's what I did. This is what I did when I opened the door. I stood naked. I was naked, and I propped it open with the shoe, but I didn't do those things. And it's the issue is the military judge did not make clear that he would not consider those additional facts. For these reasons, the court should set aside the conviction.
Thank you, Your Honor. Right. Amicus, on behalf of the appellant, you may proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Jillian Romps, and I, along with my fellow students, Alex Van Wagner and Jonah Kunisch, and supervised by Professor Siefel from the University of Denver, have been invited to present an argument relating to our amicus curiae brief on behalf of the appellant in this case of United States v. Staff Sergeant Marshallik. In doing so, we seek to provide the court with additional case law and analysis regarding the second issue before the court today. We respectfully urge the court to conclude that the care inquiry was insufficient because the military judge failed to provide the depth and clarity required for a complete inquiry, and because the military judge failed to conduct the inquiry with the heightened level of scrutiny required when an act is constitutionally protected but may be service discrediting. In doing so, we argue that proving providence of a plea in a plea inquiry is essential to providing fair notice to the accused and adequately protecting any liberty interest involved. The accused must be on notice that the conduct to which they are pleading guilty is criminal. In this case, Staff Sergeant Marshallik was not provided with fair notice. The requirement of fair notice stems from the Fifth Amendment right to due process. If the accused is on notice, they understand the offense they are pleading guilty to. The burden to ensure that the accused understands their plea and what they are pleading guilty to falls on the military judge. The military judge has the responsibility to ensure that the record reflects a clear, shared understanding of the terms of any pretrial agreement between the accused and the convening authority. To fulfill this responsibility, military judges often conduct a care inquiry from United States v. CARE. That inquiry has four requirements. Those requirements are, first, the military judge must establish a factual basis for the plea. Second, confirm that the plea is voluntary. Third, ensure that the plea is informed and intelligent. And fourth, resolve any inconsistencies. In this case, the military judge failed to fulfill two of those requirements. First, the military judge failed to establish a factual basis for the plea, and second, to resolve any inconsistencies. In regard to those inconsistencies, Staff Sergeant Marshallik admitted to committing indecent conduct under Article 134 by standing at or near the door of his residence naked in view of the public. The care inquiry contains the same facts. Sergeant Marshallik said he would open the door, prop it open with a shoe, and be in the doorway for 10 to 20 seconds in doing so. However, the stipulation of fact includes witness testimony that he allegedly posed on one occasion and touched his penis on another occasion. In the care inquiry, the military judge asked Staff Sergeant Marshallik if he understood if the two witnesses were to testify, they would testify to those facts cited in paragraphs 5 and 6 of the stipulation of fact, and that he was not admitting to the truth of what those witnesses said. However, without the facts in paragraphs 5 and 6, there are not sufficient facts for a guilty plea of indecent conduct. However, the military judge relied on those facts in order to inform the guilty plea and in order to decide that the guilty plea was provident. Staff Sergeant Marshallik never admitted to anything more than standing at the doorway of his home naked. These facts cited do not support the charge, causing ambiguity in the record. The result of this ambiguity is that there is no sufficient factual basis for the plea, which leads to the military judge's second failure, the failure to establish a factual basis for the plea. If Staff Sergeant Marshallik simply stood near the doorway of his home naked, his conduct falls short of indecent conduct under Article 134. So what constitutes indecent conduct? There are two ways to establish what constitutes indecent conduct. First, it must be either enumerated under Article 134, or a service member of ordinary intelligence must be reasonably expected to conclude that the conduct is indecent. Standing naked is not enumerated under Article 134 as indecent conduct, so we move to the alternate standard. Case law provides guidance as to what conduct a service member could reasonably be expected to conclude is indecent. The appellant already mentioned United States v. Carlisle, which is distinct from this case because Staff Sergeant Marshall's conduct was not targeted toward anyone in particular, especially not minors. He did not even know for certain if anyone could see him or if anyone did see him. Additionally, in United States v. Morales, taking photos of clothed individuals in public without their knowledge was not considered indecent. It was merely socially unacceptable, meaning that conduct may be socially unacceptable without being criminally actionable under Article 134. We argue that Staff Sergeant Marshallik's conduct may be similarly unacceptable, but not criminal, because while it may offend someone to see him naked, his actions fall short of criminally indecent.
Counsel, I have a question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it has to do with what the military judge could properly consider. So on the one hand, we have what the appellant told the military judge during the care inquiry. On the other hand, we have the stipulation of fact. So which of those two, or both of them, can the military judge use to establish the appellant's understanding of why he was guilty of the charge of offense? Is it just what he says verbally, or how can he use the stipulation?
The military judge may use the stipulation of fact to inform the care inquiry. However, it is important that the military judge ensure that the accused understands what they're pleading guilty to in the care inquiry, and that includes addressing the stipulation of fact. In this case, the military judge did address that stipulation and asked if Sergeant Marshall understood that what the witnesses would testify to, but not the truth as to what they would testify to. In doing so, that Sergeant Marshall agreed that they would testify to that, but not to the truth of those facts. And therefore, there is ambiguity in the record, and without those facts, there's not enough facts, there's not sufficient facts to for a guilty plea of indecent conduct.
So you're arguing that the appellant had a liberty interest in this conduct. Is that liberty interest met simply because the appellant was at or near the doorway to his home when he exposed himself naked, as opposed to maybe being in the front yard?
Yes, Your Honor. We argue that liberty interest arises from the constitutional right to privacy. And my colleague, Alec, will talk more about that. But yes, we do agree that liberty interest arises from this constitutional question of privacy, and that because Staff Sergeant Marshall was standing in the doorway, privacy is at issue here, rather than standing outside or standing fully in the public, which leads into my next point, which is that there's no reason to believe that Staff Sergeant Marshall's conduct was public. In United States v. Dunn, the Supreme Court determined that the curtilage of a house is determined by several factors, including proximity to the home, enclosure, use of the space, and any steps to protect it from observation. Also, in Florida v. Jardines, the court found that the front porch of a house is within the boundaries of the curtilage and therefore private. If the front porch and doorway are private, then Staff Sergeant Marshall's actions were not criminal. He never exited the house while naked, never called attention to himself, or did anything else to invite observers into the space. He did not know for certain if anyone was on the street when he opened the door, nor did he plan to open the door when there were more people present or when the street was busier, and there were people more likely to see him. He was not even aware that two women had seen him on the two separate occasions cited in the stipulation of fact. As a result, Staff Sergeant Marshall's conduct falls under the constitutional right to privacy and is therefore entitled to a heightened inquiry in the care inquiry. So by failing to resolve significant inconsistencies and failing to establish a factual basis for the plea, the military judge did not ensure that the plea was provident. However, there is another layer to establishing provenance in this case specifically that my co-counsel, Mr. Van Wagner, will discuss.
Before that, I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
You reference the concept of courage. Is that not a Fourth Amendment concept that has to go with whether there's a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to whether the government is free to enter and search?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a Fourth Amendment right, and these cases do refer to that Fourth Amendment right. However, it can be applicable here as well to determine whether or not Staff Sergeant Marshallik was in public or in private, which is important to establishing whether or not there was a constitutional question at issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Alexander Van Wagner. Primarily today I'll discuss how the military judge failed to conduct a heightened inquiry as required by United States versus Hartman. First, I'll discuss the history behind Hartman and then describe the existing case law demonstrating the Hartman inquiry and its expansion into other UCMJ articles. Then discuss and recognize how constitutional principles and case law suggest that a constitutional gray area exists within Staff Sergeant Marshallik's case, therefore requiring a heightened Hartman inquiry per United States versus Byung-Hun Kim. The military has long recognized that service members are held to a higher standard. Constitutional protections that are afforded to civilians can be punished within the military. For example, Article 134, the general article, punishes any conduct that is prejudicial to either good order and discipline or discredits the service. Article 125, a UCMJ article that is no longer in effect, sodomy, was at issue in United States versus Markham. Previously, to United States versus Markham, there was Lawrence v. Texas, which struck down the Texas state sodomy statute as unconstitutional. And Markham sought to recognize and rectify the situation between this constitutional liberty provided by Lawrence v. Texas and the military. And in that, they created the test, the Markham test. And while that test is not exactly applicable here, the test was important in seeking to rectify the variances between the civilian and military worlds in regards to constitutional liberties. Later, Hartman dealt with the guilty plea for Article 125 of sodomy. By that time, Lawrence and Markham were already in effect. The military judge did not discuss Markham or Lawrence with the pleading defendant. And then later at CAP, Hartman then held that there needs to be a true discussion between the pleading service member and military judge between conduct that might have constitutional protections and the one that is prohibited. Future cases within both this court and CAP have expanded Hartman into other cases than just sodomy. For example, just a few months ago, United States versus Sanger, which was a violation of Article 92, dereliction of duty, an airman espoused racist rhetoric contrary to Air Force policy. This court connected that Sanger had a potential constitutional offense within the First Amendment due to the freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. This court then held and required that a military judge should ask what makes the pleading defendant's behavior distinguishable from permissive behavior and later became prohibited. CAF later held in United States versus Byung-Hun Kim that an Article 134 violation for indecent conduct where the soldier watched pornography. The pornography was entirely legal. It was produced legally, it had consensual actors, and it didn't have any child actors. However, he was pleading to it because it was connected to his other crimes. So, for example, he was pleading guilty to Article 120 for another sexual assault rape. And this pornography was specifically at taglines, specifically where it was looking at things such as rape sleep. And then CAP recognized that watching and possessing legal pornography is constitutionally protected by Stanley v. Georgia in the 60s. However, despite this constitutional liberty, he still pleaded. So to rectify this disconnect, the CAP held that a military judge should ask why the pleading defendant's behavior is divorced from constitutional protections. In summary, both Sanger and Kim ruled that the military judge failed to hold a sufficient Hartman inquiry while expanding Hartman into more than just sodomy and Lawrence challenges. I also realize that I'm starting to run out of time. I only ask that I need a 1 minute more, if that is all right, Your Honors.
Yes, please.
Of course. Thank you. So there's an overall theme here, that pleading to conduct that could be connected to prior recognized constitutional offenses or protections in case law or constitutional principle requires there to be a heightened inquiry under Perkins. So there is prior case law that kind of alludes a little bit to this potential right. So in the First Circuit, Richard B. Thurston described a litany of personal liberties, including the right to appear nude in one's home. In Lawrence v. Texas, Justice Kennedy wrote that the 14th Amendment and Due Process Clause drafters could not account for every single instance of liberty. And Lawrence recognized that Americans have the liberty to engage in private consensual sexual conduct in their own home. And while no explicit right to be nude in one's home exists, it is fact dependent on the case. And at the end of the day, the staff's argument of Shalek is an error. While service members are held to a higher standard, his pleading suggested that he didn't see people when naked, people did indeed see him naked. And while there may be this personal liberty, his pleas suggest otherwise. In other words, there's this gray area. And it's exactly what United States v. Young and Kim discussed. And rationalize that Harmon was specifically suited to resolve these constitutional gray areas. And so cases like Parkman, Kim, Sanger, and Markham have always maintained this. And simply put, the military judge did not do this. For these reasons, we concur with the appellant that the care inquiry was insufficient and the guilty plea improvident. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, if we determine that appellant's conduct was public, should we still apply a heightened inquiry standard simply because he was standing at or near his doorway?
From my understanding of the case law, Your Honor, even if it is public, the service member is still entitled to understand whether or not they have potential constitutional defenses in this. So, like, for example, I'm going back to Sanger. This was a pure violation of Air Force policy. He even pleaded that he kind of understood that there was this Air Force policy that existed. However, he still violated it. So in this case, if this court was to rule that his acts were indeed public, I believe that he is still entitled to understanding whether or not he's aware of these constitutional liberties afforded to him.
So you would still ask this court to apply the heightened inquiry standard?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government?
Chief Judge Johnson, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Regina Hedenwater, and along with my co-counsel, Major Allison Gish, we represent the United States. Appellant stood naked in his doorway for his unsuspecting community to see because it sexually excited him. He offered to plead guilty for that specific offense, and that is what he did. Now, appellant is seeking to overturn his plea through the preemption doctrine, when it's the guilty plea he asked for, and this court should not permit him to do this. To that end, this court should overturn its holding in Jones to the extent that it considered preemption under clauses 1 and 2 of Article 134 and issue of subject matter jurisdiction. The basis of preemption is that it fails to state an offense. Since failure to state an offense is not a question of subject matter jurisdiction and can be waived, so too can preemption. Back in Jones, this court expanded past narrow holding in Robbins to say that preemption as a whole is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction and therefore couldn't be waived. Later, in Kostianis and Hill, this court said that the basis for preemption is that it failed to state an offense. If we look at our Supreme Court precedent in Cotton and our CAC precedent in Humphreys, both held that failure to state an offense is not a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. It does not deprive the court martial of the ability to hear the case. Because of this, Jones, as it stands, is unworkable. When we look back at Robbins that Jones was coming from, appellant argues that Robbins was holding preemption is subject matter jurisdiction wholesale. But that's not what the court was saying in Robbins. If we look back at Robbins, it is specifically talking about an Article 134 charge that was a state offense being assimilated under Article 134. And it said, in this case, the issue relates to subject matter jurisdiction. If the offense was improperly assimilated, it was not cognizable by a court martial. Thus, we hold that preemption was not waived by an appellant's guilty plea in that case. That is very different than when we have charges that are coming in under Clause 1 and Clause 2. By the language of Article 134, charges that are brought under Clause 2, under Article 134, are maybe taken cognizance of by a court martial. They do not have the same kind of potential for a subject matter jurisdiction issue that existed in Robbins when we're dealing with the Assimilated Crimes Act. And Taft pointed out, he quoted the Assimilated Crimes Act for why it was different. Whoever is guilty of any act or omission which, although not made punishable by any enactment of Congress, would be punishable if committed in the jurisdiction of the state. That is a jurisdictional limit in the Assimilated Crimes Act. But we don't have that kind of limit under Article 134. If we are charging an offense under Article 134, Article 134 is given a subject matter jurisdiction over that offense. That is what subject matter jurisdiction is. So there's sort of, when we're looking at Robbins, there was this layer, almost, of subject matter jurisdiction. The issue wasn't that we didn't have subject matter jurisdiction under Clause 3 of Article 134. It's that the government had to have subject matter jurisdiction of that state offense through the Assimilated Crimes Act. That would be where there's potential for a subject matter jurisdiction issue to arise. But we don't have that just based on the plain language of Article 134. So to the extent that Jones took Robbins to say preemption wholesale is subject matter jurisdiction, it expanded Robbins beyond the facts of that case to facts that it didn't apply to. And the reason we circle back to that is Robbins was made without the benefit of the Supreme Court in Cotton, and without the benefit of, and then Jones was made without the benefit of Humphreys in 2012.
Your counsel, let me jump in. When we talk about preemption, we're looking at sort of congressional intent and then whether the elements are residual of an enumerated offense.
Yes.
And that's the same whether we're applying Clause 1, 2, or 3, do you agree?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the test for preemption is the same. Why should preemption work differently? In both cases, we're just taking, we're looking at something that's not being charged under an enumerated offense in the UCMJ and seeing whether there is something in the UCMJ that already preempts that error. Whether it's a state statute or it's something created on the basis of being prejudicial to good order and discipline or of a nature to bring discredit on their enforcement. If the test is the same, why should it work differently?
It should work differently, Your Honor, because it still relates to the court's ability to hear the offense. The test for whether or not something is preempted doesn't actually consider the cognizance of the court martial. It is more aligned to the concept of failure to state an offense. And we can actually get that if we look at some of our the verbiage in the MCM itself. When we first start talking about jurisdiction, it's Article 18, 19, and 20 that says that charges that are brought under the UCMJ are punishable by a court martial. And if we look at RCM 307, that's the discussion section addresses preemption. And RCM 307 is about charging. And RCM 307, 3-2C, or I call this 3-2 discussion section. How to allege an offense, charging, and then it says preemption. An offense specifically defined by Article 81 through Article 132 may not be alleged to violate Article 134. That doesn't say anything about a court's ability to hear that offense. It is basically equating it right in the discussion section to a failure to state an offense issue. It isn't being discussed in terms of the court's ability to adjudicate that offense. So even though the text is the same, no matter which clause we're under, there might be a subject matter jurisdiction issue under Robbins that can exist when we are assimilating an offense because the federal statute we're assimilating it under might have a jurisdictional block to it.
So, counsel, I don't mean to interrupt your flow, but just to get my mind around it. So you're suggesting that we overrule Jones to the extent that clauses 1 and 2 of Article 134 are different than clause 3.
When it comes to subject matter jurisdiction.
When it comes to subject matter jurisdiction. So is Robbins still a good law?
Your Honor, to the extent that Cotton and Humphreys have sort of reopened the door as to what should be considered subject matter jurisdiction, we do, after this court, invite CAF to reassess Robbins to see if they still agree that this issue is subject matter jurisdiction, but to the extent that it is still good law, yes, this court can overrule Jones without having to say that Robbins was wrongly decided.
So to put your answer maybe a slightly different way, we're still bound by Robbins, and we should consider ourselves still bound by Robbins.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, do you agree Jones is long settled precedent?
Not entirely, Your Honor. I understand that it's from 2008. I suppose that's a matter of the opinion of what is long settled precedent. I don't believe that Jones has been exceptionally heavily relied upon in our military justice system. It has come up in this specific issue several times, but for the most part, the cases that were cited in the briefs make up pretty much the whole history of how Jones has been applied afterwards, which actually brings us back to when we look at how this court was interpreting Jones and preemption in Hosannis, Hills, and Bailey, that's when we kind of have this court realizing preemption is a matter of failure to state an offense. And that's when we circle back to Cotton and Humphreys, which is, if it's not failure to state an offense, isn't a question of subject matter jurisdiction. It's a question of, I apologize, failure to state an offense is not an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. And if preemption is based in failure to state an offense, then preemption can't be an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. And so when we circle back around to that, we take it all together, Jones is unworkable. Because it's saying we're saying at the same time this is failure to state an offense, but then we're also saying it's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. And that's in the whole under Cotton and Humphreys. So going forward, this court should be treating preemption under clause 1 and clause 2 as failure to state an offense and analyzing it under that text. And in this case, failure to state an offense would be waived by virtue of appellant's unconditional guilty plea. By operation of law, he waived this issue by pleading guilty.
But just those cases that you just said, specifically the Maya Sandoval and Hosannis, relying on Robert and Jones, didn't they specifically say the issue of preemption can either be waived nor forfeited?
They did, Your Honor, but we know from our precedent at CAF under Day that when you make an unconditional guilty plea, you waive all defects that are not jurisdictional. If this court says that preemption is on par with failure to state an offense, which it already has, then it's not jurisdictional. And it's waived by operation of law through the unconditional guilty. And that's what the CAF has said in Day. So, circling back to just our stare decisis analysis, we know that this is unworkable. We know that after Cotton and after Humphreys, Jones is kind of untenable at this point because it's failure to state an offense, preemption is failure to state an offense, but it should not be analyzed the same as subject matter jurisdiction. And going to sort of whether or not this is settled law, Your Honor, and a reasonable expectation of service members, He does not, like, service members should not get to have an expectation that they can be charged with offenses, offered to plead guilty, especially in this situation where he suggested the very language that made up the Article 4 of 134 charge he was convicted of. He's the one who said in the guilty plea, I offer to plead as follows, and then suggested all that language. They shouldn't get to expect that it's okay, and they can keep my fingers crossed, because I have an escape hatch through the preemption doctrine. That's important.
Who has the ultimate authority or responsibility over the charges that go forward in a court martial?
It is the government, Your Honor. It is, Your Honor. But to the extent of that, we still have to look at what appellants in the case and what future accused should be able to expect. It is not the efficient administration of justice to say, even though preemption is plaintiff is failure to take offense, and failure to take offense can be waived by a guilty plea, we're going to give preemption greater appellate protection than we do failure to take offense. Because when you compare the two grounds, you can say they are very similar. Failure to take offense is absolutely the basis for preemption. Failure to take offense is arguably worse than a charge that was brought that should have been brought and it was preempted by an earlier charge. Because technically, failure to state an offense might mean that he was not convicted of a charge under the UCMJ. There was an element in it, there was a defect in the indictment. That is worse than what preemption is. Because while we appreciate, we're not speaking here to say preemption should be done away with. Preemption isn't saying that you were not charged with a crime. Preemption is saying there was a better crime we should have charged you with, and that's why there's an issue.
So it was the issue that by charging under 134, the government no longer has the requirement or the burden to prove the intent element. Isn't that the issue here?
It's part of the issue here, Your Honor, but that's sort of circles back to the very nature of guilty pleas. The government has a burden to allege all the correct offenses to a crime in every court martial. But if we drop an element and an appellant wants to come back and say that's failure to state offense, we already know that's waivable by a guilty plea. Preemption should be given the same treatment. This is not the government advocating from a position of we should be allowed to charge anything we want under Article 134, and as long as we do that, preemption will fail. This is about guilty pleas. This is about telling an appellant, if you're going to be guilty, you are waiving this issue. And I think it's important to remember, Your Honor, that this can still come up in a litigated court martial. It's important to send a message to defense to say, if you are worried about preemption, you need to raise this. You need to take it up, because then if they don't take it up at court martial, it's only reviewed for plain error on appeal. This is about making sure that everything is being handled in an efficient manner at the court martial. And I think when you look at the risk of undermining public confidence in the law, we should want to align with what the Supreme Court says. We should want to align, and we are bound by Supreme Court precedent, we should want to align by what the Supreme Court has said about failure to state an offense. And I think that's what the public expects us to do. So to the extent that this court is saying preemption and failure to state an offense, but still applying Robbins to say it's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction can't be waived, that is putting us, with respect to Clause 1 and Clause 2, that is putting us in contention with Cotton and Taft and Humphreys. As it stands, Jones undermines public confidence in the agreements for a little bit for what I said earlier, which is the idea that an appellant keeps some sort of escape hatch to get out of the plea after the fact.
Well, counsel, couldn't the government have presented all of this by recognizing the preemption problem in light of Jones being a public precedent of this court for 15 years?
We could have, Your Honor, but to the other step, Humphreys came after Jones. And the CAP has continued to say that failure to state an offense is waivable, or if it's an litigated trial, it's only taken up as a matter of plain error review. So the government, it's not necessarily on the government in the same way as it might be in other situations. Not to say that the government is without any responsibility in this situation, but I think, as appellant was saying earlier, about all the parties came to this agreement, this came from appellant. There is nothing in the record to suggest that the government, after charging three different offenses, came back and said, we're going to offer you a preempted charge, just plead guilty to it. That's not what happened here. He came back and said, this is the conduct I move plead guilty to.
Is it legally significant who suggested this change to the justification?
I think it, from a perhaps not legally significant to that degree, Your Honor, but I think it is significant from a policy perspective. We shouldn't want to create a basis where an appellant thinks, if I'm charged with any kind of offense under the UCMJ, you know, or effectively the defense counsel thing, if you're charged with any offense under the UCMJ, you can come back and say, we're going to negotiate this down to an Article 134. And then don't worry, once you plead guilty to this, once we come to the CCA, we're going to say, this was preempted, so they can never do this. Thank you and goodbye. The conviction is entirely gone. That doesn't make sense from a policy perspective and for the effective administration of justice. This court previously said in Tennant that securing a favorable pretrial agreement via a guilty plea and then attacking the facial legality of one of those specifications is being consistent with the fair and efficient administration of justice. We should not be promoting this kind of disconnect about preemption. We should be saying this is failure to state an offense, it is waivable, you pled guilty, this would wait.
Point of clarification.
Yes,
counsel. Your brief argues and you argue today that the issue was waived. So are we to apply, and your brief goes straight into a preemption argument. So what standard of review should we be applying? Is it waived so there's nothing for us to review, or is it forfeited and we're reviewing the plan?
Our position, Your Honor, is that it was waived, and we cite it back to you today because this was an unconditional guilty plea. This was a non-jurisdictional issue. It was waived by operation of law.
So, same question I asked previously. What is your argument that this would survive a plain error?
The preemption argument itself, Your Honor? Well, Your Honor, to clarify my position in the brief, we don't actually concede that this offense was preempted. Looking at the elements of the charge itself, the first element in indecent exposure is that you had to expose a leader to body part. That is not what he was charged with. He was charged with standing naked in full view of the public. And so we would argue that being charged with standing naked is not the same as being charged with exposing a specific body part. And I'm not, I need to get this, but I want the court to consider a kind of a different fact pattern just for a moment. Imagine if this wasn't a charge of standing naked in his doorway. What if a opponent had run naked streaking across the track at a base? But everyone could see he was naked, but he was further than 100 feet away and no one could make out a particular body part, but they could make out that he was naked. It wouldn't be right to say that Article 120C preempts that conduct. Because then we wouldn't be able to charge him at all. If we can't produce a witness who says he was intentionally exposing his penis to us, we can't charge him. And that's very similar to what we have here. He pled guilty, and if you look at the colloquy, I will note for the record, the word penis, genitalia, and butt do not appear in the entirety of the record until we get past the colloquy and he's found guilty. So when you look at it like that, he knew he wasn't pleading to indecent exposure because this was a different offense. We did not just mitigate or lower our evidentiary burden, understanding that the concern is regarding the intent, specifically the intent element. We had to prove he was naked. If you look at an indecent exposure specification, you don't technically have to prove that he was naked. You just have to prove that this particular body part was exposed. You could be entirely dressed, but have your zipper down so that your penis is exposed, and that can be an indecent exposure.
Isn't being naked one way of exposing?
It is, Your Honor, but I think it's important to look at this as this was a wholesale exhibition of his body. This wasn't the intentional exposure of just one body part.
If he hadn't exposed his genitalia, would he have been charged with saying that?
doorway with underwear on. Just sitting in the doorway for his neighbors to walk past, I think the government would still be charging with under indecent conduct if you were displaying your body in a way that was indecent. Perhaps we would have to make a slightly different argument on indecency, but it's the same kind of situation. We care about his entire body. We care about him being naked. We care about him exhibiting his body to his unsuspecting community who are just trying to walk to and from the train station every day. It wasn't just about the exposure of a particular body part. And to the extent that the court is concerned about the intent element, we know under Avery that we can't consider the services credit major, but that's with respect to the residuum of the element. I would ask the court to consider a different case, United States versus Taylor. That this is from a case that was Taylor, 38 CMR 393 at 395, USCMA 1986. This court recently cited that case in Cosmianx. It's filled with law. That was a case of arguing that a self-inflicted injury is preempted under Article 115, but he was charged under Article 134. And the reason was they didn't have the intent requirement to charge it as malingering under Article 115. And what the court said was, that is an acceptable thing to do under Article 134, is to prioritize the objective orientation that is calculated to preserve good order and discipline without necessarily considering the particular mental attitude of the accused in committing a disruptive act. Article 134 and the preemption doctrine do not create some black and white rule that says if you drop the intent element, you were preempted, you fail. That is not what the preemption doctrine says. It says that it has to be made of a residuum of the elements, and it has to be wholly Congress has to be intended to wholly occupy this field. Just based on what we discussed, they did not have that intent. There's no legislative history to prove that intent. We get past the concern in Grijalva if these elements were not the same, like we dealt with in Grijalva, like have dealt with in Grijalva. And you can consider the services credit and nature of conduct when looking from a congressional intent, legislative history standpoint. And cognizant of my time moving along, I would like to move on to the liberty of the case.
I have one final question. Just couch your last argument in terms of case law. I believe it was the Avery case that held that indecent language under Article 134 encompassed a broader type of language, not necessarily encompassed within 120B's indecent language toward a child.
Yes, John.
And so is it your position that there is a broader type of indecent conduct involving exposure that can be charged under 134 that isn't envisioned under 120C?
Yes, Your Honor.
And can you give us an example of a naked exposure that would not constitute 120C?
I think going back to the example from earlier, Your Honor, that if he was jogging around the base naked, but people were too far away to see, that could still reach a level of indecency, but not reaching even exposure, because we may not have a witness who can say, I saw this piece of his body. I think that there has to be a difference, and that there has to be a window that the court is still able to say, we are prosecuting you for that, because that was indecent, even if we can't get a witness who says, I saw your penis. Turning to the liberty interest in this case, and understanding the position of the amicus. The Markman factors did apply in this case. And the reason that is important is because if you fail any of the three Markman factors, with regard to a constitutionally corrected liberty interest with sexual activity, if you fail those Markman factors, you do not make it to a heightened Hartman inquiry. And we, from the beginning of appellants, we knew we were outside of the factors that were considered by Lawrence under the second Markman factor because this was public. The very first thing that the military judge explained to appellant, well, in the initial explanation of definitions and what the appellant should be cognizant of, he explained the difference between private and public sexual activity. He explained open and notorious is not private. It can be open and notorious when you know someone else is present, or it can be open and notorious when the act occurs under circumstances in which there is a substantial risk that the act could be witnessed by someone else, even if no such discovery occurred. That was one of the first explanations the military judge gave appellant. And then we had, from the beginning, numerous statements by appellant as to how public his exhibition of his body was. And while appellant is trying to persuade the court now that, oh, he just opened the door and propped it with a shoe, that ignores the rest of the colloquy. I understand, believe I was in public view, record at 30. There was potential people who see me on the road, record at 30. I knew people walked and drove on the road and could see me if they looked at my house, record at 30. He expected, on the two occasions that he was envisioning this, one in the morning, one in the evening, he expected about 2 to 3 or 4 to 5 people to walk down the road during those times because he knew Station Road, I should probably gather from his name, was the road that went to the train station and people who used it to get to and from work. I would be in the doorway long enough for someone to potentially see me, 10 to 20 seconds. I would see her report to the visitor, I'm now counting down, 10 to 20 seconds is not brief and fleeting as the appellant would have you believe. It's now been 10 seconds. I would say that.
Let me come in. Could you address what the military judge's proper use of the stipulations with respect to testimony, for lack of a better term, would have been with regard to the guilty plea?
I believe he considered them correctly, Your Honor, in that appellant has said he did not agree to these facts. So I would echo Judge Morgan that if appellant was not agreeing to these facts as it exists, he was just agreeing that the witnesses would testify to them. They were not necessarily facts to be considered with respect to the actus reus of his offense. They could be considered going toward the terminal element that a witness is willing to testify to these additional details of what they saw when they walked past. But to that extent, they were not facts that created a substantial conflict within the record.
Wouldn't the appellant also have to believe that he was guilty of the terminal element?
Yes, Your Honor, and appellant did believe that he was guilty of the terminal element because in his colloquy, he explained from his perspective that he knew it was service discrediting and could damage the reputation of the Air Force and public team to be seen naked, standing naked in his doorway.
And here you're referring to his colloquy, not to the expected testimony.
No, Your Honor, I apologize. Your question was, did he believe that?
Yeah.
Yes, appellant believed that, and he testified to that he understood why the service was crediting, and he knew that he had been witnessed, and that he had brought down the reputation of the military through that. I think my time has expired. May I agree with you, please?
Briefly.
Appellant prominently pled guilty to standing naked in his doorway in view of the public. The preemption doctrine should not be applied to Clause 1 and Clause 2 of Article 134 to say that his conviction must be set aside due to a subject matter jurisdiction issue. This court should affirm the conviction of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Amicus, on behalf of the appellee, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Ari Protas, and along with my partner, Camilla Baxi, we represent Amicus Curiae in support of the government appellee. Specifically, we address the second issue certified for oral argument, whether the military judge failed to determine whether appellant's conduct fell within a protected liberty interest, thereby rendering appellant's guilty plea improvident. Appellant asserts he had a protected liberty interest under Lawrence v. Texas, and therefore was entitled to heightened plea inquiry under United States v. Hartman. In a heightened plea inquiry, the military judge is under obligation to assure a defendant was aware of and acknowledged the critical distinction between constitutionally protected and criminal conduct. A heightened plea inquiry is a confirmation by the defendant that their conduct is not constitutionally protected. Despite relying on Hartman for the assertion that he's entitled to heightened plea inquiry, appellant has failed to make a colorable argument that his conduct is constitutionally protected. United States v. Markham, upon which the Hartman court relied for its decision, provides that the tripartite framework for determining whether a defendant is entitled to heightened plea inquiry. It is this framework, which appellant has failed to address, that amicus would like to bring to your attention. The Supreme Court of the United States has recognized consenting adults have a protected liberty interest to engage in private sexual conduct in their home. Appellant's conduct, however, is far removed from the type of private consensual sexual activity protected under Lawrence. Since appellant's actions were public, non-consensual, indecent, and service discrediting, they fail each of the three prongs of the Markham framework. Accordingly, appellant was not entitled to heightened plea inquiry under Hartman, and his plea was properly accepted as provident. The Markham framework asks and requires an appellant to satisfy all three prongs of the test. If the appellant's conduct fails to satisfy any prong of the Markham test, then the conduct falls outside of the protection of Lawrence and does not trigger the need for a heightened plea inquiry. When looking at the Markham framework in the context of the military, the record must reflect that the court must consider the specialized society that is the military and the zone of autonomy occupied by an individual. The Markham framework asks three questions. First, was the conduct of a nature to bring it within the liberty interest identified by the Supreme Court? Second, did the conduct encompass any behavior or factors identified by the Supreme Court as outside of the analysis in Lawrence? And third, are there additional relevant factors fully in the military context environment that affect the nature and reach of the Lawrence liberty interest? We assert as amicus that appellant has failed all three prongs of the Markham framework, thus bringing his conduct outside the protections of Lawrence and the need for a heightened plea inquiry. As to the first prong of the Markham framework, was the conduct of a nature to bring it within the liberty interest identified by the Supreme Court? The liberty interest identified by the Supreme Court in Lawrence has two prongs. First, the private nature of the conduct, and second, the consensual nature of the conduct. Appellant's public exposure defeats any claim of privacy in this case. During his care inquiry, appellant admitted that his actions were not private as he understood and believed that he was in view of the public when he stood at or near his residence naked on more than one occasion between the 9th of August and on or about the 4th of October 2022. See the record at page 30. A defendant's constitutionally protected liberty interest is not absolute, and activities are not protected from prosecution simply because they occur in or around the home. To quote Cap the United States, what a person knowingly exposed to the public, even in his own home or office, is not a subject of protection. Appellant admitted that this wasn't private. One of the reasons he opened the back door was the potential that someone might see him, as seen on the record of trial at page 36 to 37. By standing naked in full view of the street and subjecting members of the public to his behavior, appellant eliminated any right to privacy which he was entitled to. It is difficult to support an argument that protected activity continues to remain protected when thrust in the view of the general public, as intentionally done here. Furthermore, to the second component of Lawrence's liberty interest, there was a lack of consent by the observers, including a minor, thereby removing his conduct further from Lawrence. As stated in the stipulation of fact and admitted by the appellant during the plea colloquy, a minor did in fact see him posing nude at the door and touching his penis. Therefore, the activity was not consensual because the witnesses did not consent to appellant's sexual behavior, because they did not give agreement to his exhibitionist conduct, nor give verbal or physical resistance. Moving now to the second prong of the Markham tripartite framework, did the conduct encompass any behavior or factors identified by the Supreme Court as outside the analysis of Lawrence? The Lawrence Court noted that the conduct before it, same-sex sodomy, was constitutionally protected because it did not involve minors or persons who might be injured or coerced, or public conduct, or prostitution. However, appellant's conduct did involve a minor, did harm witnesses, and we would also ask that the court consider the indecent nature of his conduct as another factor, taking it outside of the analysis in Markham and Lawrence and Hartman. First, appellant's new exposure to a minor, as stipulated within the facts, page 5-6, and then admitted by the appellant on page 36, a minor, L.B., did in fact see him naked, posing, and touching himself. Furthermore, appellant's nude exposure did harm a witness in this case. A.B., who said that her, the conduct was a, who said that the, that incited fear and anxiety to leave her home as a member of the community in which Appellant's conduct transpired. And finally, as to the fact that, that we ask this court to consider is the indecency of Appellant's conduct. The door is held open for lower courts to address the scope and nature of the right identified in warrants, as well as limitations based on context and factors the Supreme Court may not have anticipated or chose not to address in warrants. The Supreme Court in warrants did not address the indecent nature of the appellant's conduct, and it's here that we would ask that this court consider it as another factor, bringing it outside the warrants analysis. Indecent means that a form of immorality relating to sexual impurity, which is grossly vulgar, obscene, and repugnant to common propriety, and tends to excite sexual desire or depraved morals with respect to sexual relations. To this point, we would like to make note that this is an objective standard, as the definition of indecency in the manuals for court martial specifically contemplates common propriety and what the standards of the community are. Standing at your door naked, touching yourself, and posing nude to the public, where you knew individuals would be passing on a daily basis, does violate that common propriety and should be considered grossly vulgar, obscene, and repugnant. Furthermore, the indecency standard requires that the actions tend to excite sexual desire or depraved morals with respect to sexual relations. As per Staff Sergeant Marshall's submission, his intent was to incite sexual depravity, sexual desires, and knew that that was a natural probable consequence of his actions. Therefore, inactive, we would like this court to consider the fact that due to his actions being indecent, it is another factor that we can go towards the Lawrence analysis and bring his conduct outside of the protection that it offers, and which Hartman therefore he is not entitled to a plea inquiry under Hartman. We now turn to the third prong of the Markham analysis, which is, are there additional relevant factors solely in the military environment that affect the nature and reach of the Lawrence liberty interest? To this point, we would like to make clear that Department of Air Force Directive 1-1.11, in effect during Staff Sergeant Marshall's alleged conduct, states, quote, "It is every airman's duty and obligation to act professionally and meet all Air Force standards at all times. Only by doing so can the United States Air Force continue to be the world's greatest Air Force and retain its time-honored culture and the vital trust, respect, and confidence of the American public." Staff Sergeant Marcellus' conduct, by his own admissions, took away that trust, respect, and confidence of the public. It was not in conformity with the duty and obligation to act professionally and meet all Air Force standards of conduct at that time. To that effect, we would also like to bring the court's attention to United States v. Stiler, where this court has similarly held that because of the defendant's actions in that case, violating Coast Guard policy, even though he did satisfy the first few prongs of the Markham framework, he was still subject to prosecution and the plea agreement was provided. I would also like to bring your attention to the current Air Force standard on ethics. Airmen must practice the highest standards of conduct and integrity in their interactions with the civilian community and must not engage in conduct that is illegal or otherwise brings discredit to the Air Force. An airman's code of ethics must be such that our behavior and motives do not create even the appearance of impropriety. Even under the current standards, Staff Sergeant Marshall's conduct did bring the appearance of impropriety to the Air Force, as his conduct was indecent and violative of the protections offered by warrants. To that effect, we would also like this court to consider that the Lawrence protections may apply differently to the members of the armed forces than they do to civilians. Here, Staff Sergeant Marcellus' zone of autonomy does not extend as fully as it would be in the civilian context in light of the established regulations and the clear military interest of discipline and order. Those are contravened by his actions. Therefore, we ask this court to reaffirm the appellant's guilty plea as provident. His conduct is not protected under Lawrence, and the protected liberty interest articulated within. His failure to Markham prongs establishes that he's not entitled to heightened plea inquiry under Hartman. His conduct was outside of the protected liberty interest articulated in Lawrence because his actions were public and non-consensual. His conduct implicated minors and harmed a community member, bringing it outside of the analysis in Lawrence. And we ask the court for to consider the indecency of his actions as another factor bringing his conduct outside the analysis in Lawrence. Furthermore, His conduct violated Air Force policy, as he did not act professionally, thereby harming the vital trust, respect, and confidence entrusted into the Air Force. For these reasons, we assert that appellant has failed the Martin test. His conduct was not protected by warrants. He was not entitled to heightened inquiry, and his plea agreement was provident.
Counsel, I have a question. So, given that we're talking about a guilty plea, in terms of the Martin analysis, are we allowed to take the expected testimony articulated in the stipulation as established facts, or are we limited to what he admitted to verbally to the military judge?
In this case, Your Honor, it's important to note that he did admit to what was stipulated in the facts. I would like to turn your attention to the trial record at page 36, where the military judge asked, is it your belief now, having seen the statements of these particular witnesses, that they did in fact see you on those dates as they have described? To which Staff Sergeant Marshall responded, yes, Your Honor. In such a case where he has admitted it, case about what's in the stipulation of facts versus what happened during his. However, in the general sense, I would defer to the appellee's statement regarding the stipulation of facts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel.
Appellant chose to plead guilty to an offense that would have otherwise been charged under Article 120 Charlie, and the government had charged under Article 120 Charlie. This is a direct quote from the government's brief at page 18. The military judge himself at page 171 plainly said Staff Sergeant Marshallet was found guilty of indecent exposure. This offense was preempted. Change in direction that it was not preempted, that the elements were different. Your Honor, this is the exact conduct that Article 120 Charlie is designed to prohibit. The court posed a question to the government related to whether there is separate conduct that may constitute indecent exposure or may constitute indecent conduct but not indecent exposure. In Carlisle, this court answered that question. In Carlisle, this court discussed the purpose and intent of creating Article 120 Charlie and carving it out of 134, and the court said it was to prohibit the type of live in-person exposure that has the temporal proximity, a live component, which was distinct from the exposure to digital means, from sending digital images. That was conduct which was indecent conduct, but not what Congress intended for indecent exposure. This case is exactly what Carlisle wasn't, exactly what this court said is the purpose of 120 Charlie. It was live, in-person nudity. That is indecent exposure, and it was preempted by Article 120 Charlie. With regard to the government's comments on stare decisis, and specifically the first factor about Jones being unworkable, Jones correctly applied the plain language of Robbins. This court has repeatedly adhered to Jones, despite multiple invitations from the government, similar to this case, making similar arguments, trying to invite this court to overturn Jones. And as this court said in Bailey, it explicitly declined to overturn Jones, understanding all the same arguments in Bailey and the recent decisions from this court, which were decided after Humphreys, after Cotton. This court's analysis has remained the same. And similar, Your Honors, one of the cases that was briefed by the government in its answer, Erickson, is a case which CAF reviewed a preemption claim. That case involved a Clause 1 and 2 preemption issue, or Article 134 offense. It was not an Assimilated Crimes Act issue. That case involved a guilty plea. The issue of waiver was not addressed. It was not a bar for CAF to review that case. And that was decided after Robbins because the court's understanding, just as this court interpreted it, is that the foundation and analysis of Robbins is that preemption is a matter of, the government said, the court's ability to hear an offense. The limiting language of the Article 134, the general article, applies equally to all three clauses. There's no separate sentence, there's no separate limitation on Clause 3 and Clause 3 alone. All three clauses are allowed to fill the gap left by Congress from the UCMJ. That's the purpose of it. And it can be done through Clause 1, 2, or 3, but the specific limitation on that is that if it is already covered under Articles 80 through 132, then that is not cognizable. And that is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, whether it's Clause 1, 2, or 3.
Well, I have a question. The indecent exposure pre-existed as an Article 134 offense or being moved to 120C.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if it already existed, what gap is Congress filling?
Your Honor, Congress specifically intended to codify it. There is no gap anymore. Before Article 120 Charlie existed, there was a gap. There was no UCMJ Article 2 other than the general article, the enumerated 134 offense. There was no Article 80 through 132, which addressed that type of misconduct. But Congress changed that when it specifically created Article 120 Charlie. I believe it's Appendix 121, the manual for court martial, includes language that Article 120 Charlie replaced Article 134 in decent exposure in its entirety. This case is an opportunity for the court to remind trial practitioners that even in guilty pleas, they are bound by the law. They are bound by the preemption doctrine in the jurisdiction of the court. Thank you.
Counsel, we thank you for your arguments. We especially appreciate the participation and efforts of the students from the University of Denver Sterling College of Law that they put into the briefs and arguments. We'll be right back here to field any questions, but may not be able to answer questions specific to any case that is before us or will be before, pending before our court. The court will render a decision in this case in due course. The court is now
ready. All rise.
Yes. Thank you.